This is The Takeaway. I'm WNYC's Shamitha Basu, in for Tanzina Vega. It's good to have you with us. Smartphones are tracking our every move. Whether you're a high school student in California or a Secret Service agent in the nation's capital. Across the globe, dozens of companies can now log the precise locations of millions of consumers through their mobile phones and then store that information in massive data files. After receiving one such data set, the New York Times went deep into the world of this location data industry. They pored over one of the largest files ever reviewed by journalists. What they found was more than 50 billion location pings from more than 12 million Americans' phones in cities across the country are being stored. And that's just a snapshot of what companies collect every single day. Apps like Google Maps can track your location, and that might not be too surprising, but apps that don't need to know your location can track you too, like coupon savers or weather apps.
It's something that I think a lot of people don't even realize is embedded within the terms of service of this application when they agree to it.
That's Charlie Worzel, an opinion writer at large for the New York Times and one of the reporters behind the investigation.
In the aggregate, this is a complete and total map of your life, and it can be as accurate down to a couple of feet, and if you're on, you know, Wi-Fi or something like that, it can be accurate down to a couple of inches.
And companies are not only collecting and storing this data, but profiting from it too.
Some of these apps have secondary businesses where they're trying to sell this location data, repackage it, and move it to different places.
I asked Charlie why location data is so valuable today.
You can derive quite a lot about a person's life from it. You know, you can sort of understand the patterns of their life. You know where they are, you know where they've been. You start to really figure out who a person is based off of this. For advertising purposes, you can target people at moments when they're most likely to want to purchase something. So you understand that they've been to five different stores. It's clear that they're, you know, looking for different types of sporting goods things. And then as they're driving into a shopping center, someone can hit them with a contextual advertisement in the middle of their Facebook feed for this specific jacket. It's one of these things where if you use location data correctly, you can stop somebody in their tracks and actually influence their behavior.
So what you're saying is it's not about just serving us ads. It's also about sort of mapping a customer journey, is sort of the phrase that comes to mind, and really creating a profile around people.
It really is, honestly, a surveillance tool. And I don't necessarily mean that in a super nefarious way, but it is collecting so much intelligence about an individual, about their life, about their preferences, about who they're with.
One thing that these data collection companies often will say is that these data points are anonymous, but you found that it's actually very easy to pinpoint exact people based on their supposedly anonymous data, correct?
This is sort of the main justification for why this industry is allowed to collect this information at scale. You know, this data is anonymous. And that's patently false, really and truly. It took us a matter of minutes when we were in the data to identify individuals. And the way that works is you can draw a little geo fence around a specific place and look for all the pings that you get. And you can isolate a specific device and then see the places, the clusters of where that phone pings the most frequently. And you're going to see two major spots, and that one is work and one is home. And if you live in a single family home, public records will show who the owner of that house is. And then, you know, a simple search on LinkedIn or social media or Facebook will show that that person works in this location. And it takes a number of minutes using these publicly available digital breadcrumbs to discern an identity. And if two or three reporters in New York City can do it with no real technical expertise, you have to imagine what a foreign government could do if they had this information.
And you demonstrated just how easy that was. You took a few pings that you saw in Pasadena, California, right? And because you, of course, knew where these people lived, because you could see their location data, you actually showed up on some people's doorsteps and talked to them about this. How did people react when they opened the door to you?
It's a surreal experience. some of these people we tried to reach out to beforehand, but many of them, like you said, we showed up on their stoop, and a number of them completely understandably wanted nothing to do with this, thought maybe, I'm sure a number of them thought we were scammers or didn't quite believe us. But those who did actually sit down, they invited us into their homes, sitting at their kitchen tables. We pulled up these maps and showed them. And, you know, there's really a range of emotions here. There were some people who were deeply disturbed by this and contacted their workplaces and said, I think this is a security violation. But others had what I thought was a surprising reaction, which is they seemed already very resigned to the fact that their privacy was invaded. They either said, well, I don't have anything to hide, or, yeah, I always figured this was going to happen. The true sort of revelation from that was that there are a lot of people who feel like they have no power over this and don't really seem to care anymore.
You mentioned that the way in which the Times obtained this data set was that a few people within the data collection industry actually brought it to you, right? And they were flagging some very real concerns that they have for this type of data being collected and stored. What are the concerns that you're hearing from people in the industry?
It's very difficult to secure this kind of data at scale. So I think there's a worry about that they just are amassing it at such scale. I think people are really worried when it comes to the application that some of the individuals at these companies could just port it over. I mean, we at the Times got access to this data, which sort of proves just how easy it is to take that from a company server and get it to strangers, essentially.
And I would imagine that those worries might shift depending on where you are in the world. How might this play out in more authoritarian regimes?
I mean, I think Hong Kong is just a great example of this because, you have both sides of the technology on display. Protesters in Hong Kong are using it to organize. They're using it to, identify areas they want to stay away from because of clusters of police officers, or to keep people safe, to try to say, hey, there's a semi-violent or intense conflict on this, side of the city. We want to stay away from that. It's helping sort of form this. And social media has obviously been such a catalyst for the democratic movement in Hong Kong. But then you're seeing this technology being used against them. You're seeing beacons and facial recognition cameras and, all of that kind of technology be used to try to identify these protesters, to try to intimidate them from actually going out and demonstrating it, to sort of squash public dissent.
Is there any argument to be made that this type of data collection could be beneficial for any of us as a society? And I'm talking about targeted ads aside.
I think it's definitely possible that this technology could be used responsibly and to decent ends. And I think that can only happen when you have the right rules and regulations in place. And also, I think more importantly, when consumers understand the agreements that they're entering into. And that doesn't mean a 15-page privacy policy that's written by a team of high-powered lawyers that you can have the option to just click agree and not read. I'm talking about really outlining the stakes of this and really letting people know what they're consenting to.
What kinds of rules or regulations are currently in place?
January 1st, California is adopting a series of privacy laws, and they will go into effect. And that is probably the strongest set of privacy laws that's going to exist at a state level. Currently, there's no federal privacy legislation, though, in Congress. They are been debating it for the last year and a half, and seem to be moving closer. But even those regulations right now don't have enough protection. They don't really have teeth, because of the fact that these technology companies have created a number of loopholes. So a great example of this is Europe put into place in 2018 GDPR, which is a large data protection law, and it allows individuals to request their own data. It allows them to take it down. It includes the right to be forgotten. It is a series of laws that gives consumers some power. But one of the problems is when it comes to location data, they don't classify location data, these companies, as personally identifiable information. And a lot of these GDPR rules only apply to personally identifiable information. So you know, these companies know how to skirt the laws. They say because this data is quote unquote anonymous, it doesn't apply. You can never request it. You can't see what we have on you. And so part of this is you need lawmakers to have a better understanding of the ways that these companies are trying to weasel out of being held accountable. And I think lawmakers need to figure out ways to give consumers sort of the ultimate power over the information that they're shedding.
So, Charlie, now that we have sufficiently freaked everyone out, what can we do on our phones right now to protect our data, or at least take some steps towards protecting our data?
There are a few things that people can do. You're going to want to go into the location settings on your phone, which is somewhere if you have an iPhone or Android in your settings, and you're going to want to take a look at all the different applications that you've granted permissions to. So, for example, you might say, "Hey, this map application is really useful. I need it to get around the city. I need it to drive, and I'm going to allow it to look at my location." But then you might see a coupon app or, an app that gives you the best gas price deals and say, "Well, I'm not comfortable. I don't know who's behind this. I'm not comfortable with that." And you'll turn it off. There are ways in your settings to disable or to reset your advertising ID, which is a way that companies can sort of look at your phone and understand things about you and use that to serve you targeted ads. The last thing I'll say is, and it's very important to know that there's really nothing right now that you can do to be 100% off the grid without throwing your phone into the Hudson River and, walking away and living on a commune. The only way we're really going to see real change when it comes to this surveillance is for lawmakers to step up and really put restrictions on technology companies and the advertising ecosystem.
Charlie Worzell is an opinion writer at large for the New York Times. Charlie, thank you for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.